welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast. This is Jessica. I'm your host today. And I am here with Rebecca Sugar, who has quite a list of accomplishments. But is this your first fiction book, Rebecca?
It is, yeah.
And it's called Everything's a Little Broken.
It is.
And I have to say, you know, we chatted a little bit before starting to record, because this book was a very personal book for myself, having just gone through some of the things that are discussed in the book. So you know what? I'm just going to ask you, tell us about Everything's a Little Broken and what it's about and sort of how you came to tell this story.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, when people tell me that this is very personal to them, I always get a little sad and a little happy at the same time. Sad because I don't want this to be so many people's story, but it is. About 41 million Americans deal with caring for an elderly parent or someone else. And so it's a lot of people's story, but you know, you just wish it weren't. This is the story of Mira Kane, who's a woman in her late 40s, whose father, Matt, is declining in health, and she's watching it happen, as a lot of us do, and trying to grapple with everything that means. And it's a long list of things that means, right? What does it mean for her relationship with him? What does it mean for her relationship with herself, with her family, with her children, with her siblings, with her friends who are going through various iterations of this? And at the same time, there's an older woman in the story, May, who was her childhood nanny and her father's childhood nanny too. So she's been in the family for 70 years, and she's in even greater decline. And spoiler alert, but it won't spoil anything for anybody, that she dies in the novel, and how Mira contends with that as well. But it's a book, it's a story, as I said, that's a little bit sad, everything's a little broken in life, and that's just true. And I wanted to talk about what's true, and not sort of pretend that it isn't true and there's no happy ending and everybody doesn't get up and do a jig at the end. But it's also told with some humor, because I think we were talking beforehand, some things are so awful that they are absurd, and in that laughable sense of being absurd, life is that way, right? Isn't it? It's, there's some things about it are just so ridiculous. You can't, there's nothing else to do but kind of giggle. And it's told with some faith, Jewish sort of elements and Christian elements in it too. And I hope it's a story that people can relate to. It's one slice of this huge issue. It's one story about one person who has physical conditions. I have friends with parents who have Alzheimer's and all sorts of other permutations of this. And I touch on them a little bit, but you couldn't possibly tell all those stories, but it's a way of connecting to the struggle, I guess.
You know, I have to say, and there's one thing that I kind of wrote down in my notes here, and I just want to say it, you know, nothing is more humbling than having to care for a parent.
Yeah.
Especially when it gets to the point that the parent or the adult, I suppose, who, you know, had been an authority figure or a caregiver, you know, is sort of reluctant to take the care that they need, because, you know, this is a person who was a full adult. This isn't like a child who's still learning. This is someone who'd been through that, but now it's so hard. And I don't know if it's just, you know, a certain generation, because my grandparents were more than happy to go to assisted living. My grandparents were more than happy to be pampered. You know, my grandfather, who was like a World War II veteran, and, you know, like they went to this nice, you know, assisted living, which is not everybody's experience. They were very fortunate to be able to afford that, of course, but they were like, yeah, let someone else take care of us. Let people cook for us. But I will say, because now that I'm thinking about it and I have this written down in my notes, that there was a point where they were like, no, enough. My grandmother never used her walker. And when my parents were in decline and my parents were baby boomers, They also, like especially my mother, whose cancer spread into her hip, did not want to use a cane, and my father, who could not walk, would not use a walker. And to them, it's humiliating. And then, like, as the caregiver, you're just like, but you're
Yes.
gonna, it's this is a recipe for disaster. So, I mean, I think like there
Yes.
was, yeah, it, some of the things in the book, it really hit on that. And one of the other things that I'd sort of written down is like maybe it's my proximity to it, but especially like in the beginning or when you're describing like the hospitals, and it's like I could smell it. I could like I felt like I was there. So you
Yeah.
really evoked that space and that sense of urgency and weirdness.
Yeah, I love this conversation about the resistance to the walker because, right, this book, though it's fiction, is heavily autobiographical, which I imagine a lot of good fiction is. And so, the father figure is really based off my father, and the main character Mira is really based off of myself and our interactions. And my father is 83 now and has had physical conditions that limited his mobility since he's 40. He had a terrible interaction with a chiropractor who did the wrong thing. And sadly, he was being paralyzed. And when he was 40 years old, he had a surgery, a spinal cord surgery, which prevented that tragedy, but left him never the same physically. And then the compounding effects of time and age and all that, it only got worse and much worse to the point where he was almost immobile. And in his, I guess, probably in his 60s already, he was walking with the cane and should have been with a walker then and refused, right? All for the same reason that sense of pride and dignity and stubborn, just ferocious stubbornness. And now really should be in a wheelchair and will not be in one. He says, once I get in one, I'll never get out, of course, and is literally just embarrassed to be seen in one. Walks with a walker now, which is a big which is a lot of progress, but really that's not even sufficient, and won't do things that in public really that require him to use the walker as much as he should. So his life is reduced down because of it, and all of it is beyond frustrating. And we make jokes about it, and I tease him about it, and I yell at him about it, and he fights with me about it, and then we laugh about it again. And at the end of the day, something I sort of end up on this side of the line. I think I'd rather my dad be a stubborn. trying to find the right word, a stubborn old guy, right? Then relent, because it is not in his nature to give in, to submit to anything. And that will to fight, even though it's a lost cause, actually, he's never gonna not need the wheelchair. But I love the fight. It keeps him going, it keeps him fighting, right? And so, as annoying as it is and frustrating, and he's fallen and it's been bad, and lucky that it didn't, bust his head open when he did. I mean, we just escaped narrowly. Still, I kind of encourage that stubborn will because it's a sign of life. And the worst moments are when you see your parent or whoever the person is just give up, even if it's for a moment, when they just say, enough already, it's just not worth it, or I don't want to, or it's too much. So I think I'd rather fight with him about not using the wheelchair that he will not get into,
Yeah, you put that very well. And there was another line that I kind of wanted to bring up where you say something about, the people in wheelchairs. I can't speak today. The people in wheelchairs seeming like they have like they're holding the weight of the world. And it's true. There is like, full disclosure. I know I'd mentioned this before at the beginning of the podcast, but I lost my mother and my father in 2022. But I also, and this is a different loss, and maybe because this was a loss I was ready for, I process it differently. Exactly 2 months before my mom passed, my grandmother, who was 97, had passed. And she had been in a luxury assisted living home for a while. She managed to live a really nice life after my grandfather passed for a while. She traveled, but she had a really bad fall because she wasn't using her walker, and eventually, ended up in like the memory wing. And I remember going in, And it was like a whole other world. Like you saw these people, and it was like they had bricks on their shoulders. So that line just really was like smacked me in the head. But you know, who's to say how things work? But it is, there is a stubbornness there. You know, there is like this life lived. And I think like one of the things that it exposes is also how you feel about your own aging, like where
Of
you are,
course.
right?
Yeah, of course. And in this story, right, Mira has a daughter who's in college and she's sort of there for parts of this and watching everything. And so, and I often think about that. I have teenage twins. I love my father and I'm very close to him and I spend a lot of time around him, not because I'm his primary caregiver, actually. I don't have to thankfully help him get dressed or move him, which would be really hard to do because he's a big guy. But I'm his emotional caregiver. We have a bond. And so especially when you're in those terrible moments in life, it's the people who are closest to you before that who really have to be the ones to be there. And so I spend time with him and, am with him out of love. But there's this little piece of my brain that also thinks, my kids are watching. How do you treat your parents as they decline when they're no longer, the force that's sort of guiding you and you have to pull parts of your life out and sacrifice time and energy on them, and the flow of energy is out rather than in. I want my kids to see that it's that it's a thing to do. It's the right thing to do. It's the thing you want to teach your kids to do, to be there and to be responsible and take care. But beyond that, that I'm not doing it just because it's the right thing to do. That even though I'm there and it's hard sometimes and I don't have time and I have a million things going on and I got to go run over there and help with this or just be on the phone and help with that, even in those moments, he's still my dad. I still get, energy from him. I still get love from him. It's still rewarding for me. So yeah, you recognize that you're headed in that direction too, and you want to model for the next generation the best ways to be in those moments, or the best that you know how to be. And so I think that matters a lot too. I think my kids, they spend a lot of time with my father and my mother, I should say, although this story focuses more on my father. That's the only reason I'm talking about him so much. Because I want them to also have that experience of it. I want them to know them, obviously, but I want them to kind of look and see what is it to have a family and to take care of them into their old age and good times and bad times. What are the responsibilities and what are the rewards? Right.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that the introduction of May was a really interesting piece to this because she's family, but she's not blood. But
Yeah.
she is family. So, how did she sort of come into the picture?
May. May was Ella May in real life. That was also a real character. Those three characters were the real ones. She was in my family for 70 years. She raised my helped to raise my father and me and my siblings. And I loved her in real life. And so I'm actually not a huge fiction reader myself. I lean more towards nonfiction. But here's what I discovered about fiction that's amazing is that you get to make things up and you get to correct real life in a sense. So I brought May back. I miss her. She died 20 something years ago and I was very connected to her. So here she is again. I got to chat with her and bring her back. What I love so many things about May, exactly what you just said, which I love that you said, right? She's family, but not family, not blood. She really was family. I mean, no question about it. But she had her own family. And part of Mira's discovery in this story is that we all, I think, see the people in our lives through our childlike eyes, the way we saw them and through our own lens and our own experience of them. But they have a whole other life. Including your own parents, right? That you find that out as they age and you age. And when it comes to May, Mira discovers over time that she understood her as the woman that lived in her home and loved her and took care of her, but she had an actual family. Broken as that was, it was hers. And so that was a piece of it. But I think the bigger piece is like May is the family memory. She's 70 years of knowing the Frank, Kane families. And importantly, she knew Mira's father before the illnesses, before the broken body. And she remembers Matt Frank as a child running around chasing his dog. Like in real life and in the story, but in real life, I've never seen my father run. Not that I can remember. I've never seen him play a game of tennis. I've never seen him lift anything heavy. Ella, or May in the book, did. She had a whole other view of him, which Mira has never tapped into until this late phase of both of their lives. And it's really been restorative for her and helpful for her to think about her father, not just as the patient sitting in the bed in front of her, right? But as the man that maybe she never even knew, but was always embedded inside of him. And maybe that's the same, that guy was chasing the dog or lifting the heavy stuff in his 20s that Mira didn't know, is the guy unwilling to get into his wheelchair now, right?
You just hit the nail on the head, 100%. I can say that from, watching with my own father and mother to a different degree because she sort of, she was my mother was always very on top of us. And then when she got sick, and this really should have been the first clue as to how sick she really retreated from us, which was not like her. And then you kind of wonder, like, hey, maybe I just missed the signs. Maybe I should have been more prepared. But you do hit the nail on the head there. And it is very, very hard. So I mean, just like some of the other stuff, that you bring into it, how did you weave the faith in and the other aspects in of the story? And yeah, I was curious about that.
Well, I mean, it would be hard to tell a story like this without talking about faith because we all grapple with it. And in this context, in this book, it has to do with Judaism and Christianity. But I mean, those are just vocabulary words, right? They stand in for people's, various ways of expressing their faith. In this case, May was Pentecostal Christian woman, and in real life, so was Ella May. And we're a Jewish family. And I always loved the colliding, or it's the wrong word because it's not an antagonistic sort of setup. It's the merging or the sort of meeting of these two faiths in my house. We were committed Jews and practicing Jews. And Ella was a very committed Pentecostal Christian woman. Her faith, though, was like different, right? Our faith was really deeply steeped in education and literacy, and hers was not, not by any fault of her own, but it was so abiding, so strong, and so deep. So there's a scene in the book where Mira's young and she's sick, and her father and May are standing by her bedside, and May is sort of doing the Pentecostal thing where they speak in tongues and incantations over the sick body, and she's drawing the sickness out of me, and my father is standing on the other side in his with his Jewish sort of mind, sort of saying, whatever he's saying in Hebrew. And like, I love that whole alchemy of faith, of ideas. It really contributed to how I see my own faith. In the book, Mira's really struggling with faith. She has a lapsed sort of sense of her own Jewish faith. And the easiest thing and the most fulfilling thing to do in the moment is to sort of glom onto May's, because it's so readily available and it's so beautiful. And they have these wonderful moments where they sort of open the Bible randomly and try to pick a verse and just speak it out loud. And the power of words, the power of language, right? All of that. And, she of course comes to this moment where she realizes and recognizes that you can't use somebody else's faith to get through hard moments. You have to resurrect your own. And maybe it's returning to the things you were raised with, or maybe it's adapting them based on new understanding of it, but it has to be yours. So I try to kind of play with both, with I hope a lot of respect for both. And then one of my favorite scenes in the book is there's a scene at the end where Mira visits a Pentecostal church. It's a real church in New York called the Greater Refuge Temple. It's up in Harlem. And sometimes I go there just to listen to the gospel music, which is absolutely world class, and I recommend it. And just to sort of feel like May is in the room with me, and I hope I do it justice. And I hope, as a Jewish person, I'm expressing my incredible love for the beauty, the sort of abiding faith, the deep sense of connection to just pure belief in God and His plan. All of that is really attractive to me, and so I tried to put that in there too.
So, did you write this book during the pandemic?
I
or you
did.
did.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, what else was one going to do while they were sitting there all day?
Bake bread. Everybody was baking bread. At least that's what I
Yeah.
thought.
I kind of hate everything about the kitchen, so that was not my way forward. I'm a writer anyway. I'm a columnist, and but I usually write about, real things. Although this was a lot of real stuff, but I really didn't know I was writing a book. I sat down and like 30 pages just sort of poured out, and I think I thought initially it was just like a big diary entry, and then nothing happened. And then months later, I sat down and basically the rest of it came out, and then I kind of manipulated it to make it a little more fictional than it was in its original form, and really, didn't think of it as a book until I sat down across the lunch table after the pandemic from somebody who's a well-known columnist, and we were chatting, and she said, "Oh, that's, I love the name of my column is The Cocktail Party Contrarian." She said, "Oh, that's so cute. She talked to my publisher, maybe he'll make a book out of your columns." And I sort of rolled my eyes and thought, "Who the heck wants to read a book of columns? But okay, how lovely of you." And didn't hear from her. And 2 months later, that August, I was cleaning out my spam folder because I literally still have the very first email address I've ever had on AOL. And everything goes to spam and AOL. So once in a while you have to clean it out. And I cleaned it out. And then the day after that woman and I had spoken, she had actually connected me to her publisher. I just never saw it. And in that space of the 2 months that had gone by, I had actually really cleaned this thing up and turned it into what I thought was a book. So it was kind of all meant to be. And I wrote to him and apologized for having AOL. And he said, "Let's talk on whatever Thursday." And literally, he had a mother who had gone through Alzheimer's. So he connected with the idea. So he said, "Why don't you send that over to me?" We talked about the column idea and he didn't like it any more than I did. Right. And then he asked, "What else have you written?" And I said, "Well, I don't know if this is the thing, but," and that's how it happened. It was very not the plan, but happy it worked out that way.
It's so funny you talk about AOL because I spent so much time with my dad towards like before he ended up in the hospital resetting his AOL password. I mean, I was that first generation or really the generation who got like AOL and little floppy disks or CDs, and you have
Yes.
to like you got free hours and then you would by the hour, but then you try to get more free. It was like the craziest thing that I don't think people would understand now who grew up with,
I was
my
gonna
kids would,
say we
my
need like
kids
a
wouldn't.
dictionary. Yeah,
But
floppy disk is not in the lexicon anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
no, it isn't. So yeah, I mean, for sure. And I've kind of left my first, I still have my first AOL email address. But I don't use it, but I do have like I'll forward things to the current email address I have. But every now and then I see it and I'm like, I really should just shut that down. I don't use it anymore. But I don't know if it's like a connection because I remember my dad setting it up. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of time spent after my, actually no, because my mom had no ability to ever even check her email, where I would just like have to get my father back into his AOL account and, go through all of his passwords and say, okay, you accidentally reset it, so we can't use this anymore. And, but I mean, it's all part of the process.
Yeah, I
It
think we should
really,
be
really is.
kinder to AOL, right? AOL,
Yeah.
like, basically help me get my book published, and it helps you to reconnect with your dad. So I think we should just give it its props, don't you think?
Yes, thank you so much, AOL. You
Thank you,
this is
AOL.
this a eulogy for AOL?
It could be. I'm not gonna shut mine down. I still have a file of facts, so you should know who you're talking to. Like, I don't like to let things go that maybe help me stay anchored in some part of the past. Although I do also have a Gmail account. But I found it very hard when I first opened my Gmail address because the format's so different and the way they kind of put the history of all the emails and the same chain together was hard to follow. I was like, gosh, AOL is so much simpler. I like simpler. But
And
now I'm
what,
used to
yeah,
both.
what's funny also is that, my kids now, they're going to be 9 in a few weeks. I have twins too. They play like all of these games that use sound bites from different things. And one of the sound bites is, "You've got mail, you've got mail." So my husband and I are sitting on the couch and they're like remixing sounds on, I don't know, some weird game that they're playing, and we're hearing, "You've got mail, you've got mail." And we're
That's
like,
hilarious. Yeah.
"You have no idea, guys. You have no idea."
No idea. I when that used to make that sound, like it was so exciting, right? Because it didn't happen all day. You didn't get mail 1,000 times a day like you do now. So when you had mail, it was like, wow, I've got mail. And you would run and check it. It's great. Yeah, I'm never getting rid of my AOL. Definitely not.
Rebecca, thank you so much. Everything's a Little Bit Broken is really good. It's a really special story. It's like you said, like it's sad that a lot of people will relate to it, but it's real and it's important to kind of know that this is something that we all sort of go through.
Yeah, I hope people find some hope in it and some laughter and also some acknowledgement of the truth of the pain that they go through. And you know what I say is that decline is not always a straight line, but it always does head in the same direction. And I accept that in life. And other people are struggling to accept it. And I hope they find some of that in here too. And I hope most of all that if they read Everything is a Little Broken, they will get in touch with me somehow online and just let me know what they think. The most important thing is to hear what people think or feel.
Thank you so much, and we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.